From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. America's innovation engine has responded to national emergencies before. In times of crisis, it's our ingenuity, our big ideas, our determination that rises up to meet the challenge. And if there ever was a moment when we need innovation, it is now. This hour On Point, innovation during the coronavirus pandemic. With us from New York City is Scott Cohen. He's co-founder of NewLab, a technology and design firm in New York. Scott, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So tell us your story as a serial entrepreneur. The mission in your mind at the beginning of this pandemic was to create a low-cost ventilator. What was the spark that got you innovating in a time of such crucial need?
Well, the spark was actually a fellow NewLab member who now lives in Amsterdam. And during the moment where Italy was really under siege by COVID-19, he reached out to myself and apparently to another colleague in NewLab, Marcel Botha, unbeknownst to us both, and asked us if we could help build a ventilator to address the crisis in Italy. And I had looked up online to see what it would take to build a ventilator, and I realized this is a really complex thing. And I actually emailed him back because I thought it was probably not something that could happen that quickly, and it might be really difficult. And then I was actually just really didn't think about it much more for the next number of days. But as things started getting really clear that this thing was heading towards New York and we really need to prepare for it, I started to really think, well, maybe this is something we should look at. And at around the same time, NewLab was confronting the fact that we needed to shut down in the next couple of weeks, and that all these engineers and roboticists and really smart people were going to be going off to wherever they would go to hunker down. I just started thinking maybe we should pay attention to this. I started looking online at other options and what possibilities were, and discovered that there were a bunch of people thinking about this, and ultimately came across a 2010 design from MIT that looked really, really interesting. And I thought it was originally intended to be a ventilator for the developing world, so low cost response to a need down there. And I sent that out to a couple of colleagues, Saul Griffith on the West Coast, and also to Marcel at our studio. And Saul, who's an amazing inventor and engineer, got back to me and said, you know, I think if you're going to focus on anything, you should focus on what MIT started designing in 2010, because that's something that could be really worked on quickly. And if you add some fidelity to it, if you add some tools, some clinician advised features to it, it could really be effective and impactful.
And so you orchestrated this incredible collaboration of scientists and engineers and entrepreneurs and doctors and regulatory experts in the midst of a pandemic, and accomplished in 1 month what normally takes a year or longer, because as you mentioned, these ventilators are complex, right? They've got thousands of parts. They've got complex global supply chains. Your goal was to do this fast. How did you make this happen so quickly, Scott?
Well, first of all, the DNA of NewLab is actually built around doing things really efficiently. We don't write white papers about ideas. We actually build things there, and that's what every person that's a member of NewLab there is. They're all building, applying frontier technology to challenges the world faces and trying to be as efficient and responsive as they can. And so the first of all, I reached out to people that I knew could do this and could respond quickly. And Marcel Botha from 10X Beta has an environment in his particular studio where you could go up to him anytime with a napkin sketch and very quickly get to a prototype of something. And the same goes for Charles Boyce at Boyce Technologies in Long Island City, which is another company that companies at NewLab and NewLab itself has worked with in the past. And they have an amazing group of engineers there as well. And the ability to prototype quickly and take something that where we maybe build one or two in our shop over at NewLab, at Boyce we can make six or seven in an afternoon of something and then test it out and see if it works.
That's interesting. Talk about that process, because I read that your engineers and and medical experts, your team, working in a socially distanced manner, of course, you know, you would make one prototype and then you'd discard it. In fact, you'd haul dozens of these versions of the ventilator off to the dumpster as you made upgrades and improvements over the course of 2 or 3 weeks. The process of that is so interesting to me, and I think is really essential as we try to understand what true innovation looks like in the midst of a crisis. What was that process?
Yeah, you have to parallel process everything. So as opposed to looking at things in a linear way, how can we test out many, many things at the same time? So in the very beginning, there was a team at MIT, there was Saul Griffith's team out in California, there was our team in New York, there's actually other teams in other places that were all getting on calls daily at 9 a.m., at 9 p.m., comparing notes, comparing what we learned, putting code onto GitHub and sharing it. So every time we made prototypes at New Lab, every day we made prototypes at New Lab or at Boyce, we would FedEx them out to teams at MIT. We'd send them by car service to MIT. We'd FedEx them to California. People would work on them. We would work on them. Wow. And then at 9 a.m. and 9 p.m., we'd get together. And our friend Patty, who volunteered to kind of manage this conversation, would ask people what they'd accomplished, whatever they're blocked on, what do they need? Mm. And then we would just distribute information. So things were happening very, very fast on in a lot of different places. But ultimately, for our team, there was a certain point, I think about 10 days in, where we really needed to just like focus in. And that's kind of when we moved to Boyce and pulled everyone that was at New Lab over to Boyce and joined with their team there. And then started doing the same kind of thing, but in a much more focused manner. And then we were still moving devices up to MIT and doing side-by-side animal studies and putting them on. You could do a porcine test where you could see with the clinicians next to the device on an animal how it's performing. And I think that was that kind of speed and parallel processing was critical. And one other really critical piece that I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up is the fact that we had clinicians that were working with us, Dr. Albert Kwan and Dr. Alexander Slocum Jr., who both trained in engineering at MIT and then became a physician. So these are people that have trained, you know, in both the engineering community and in the medical community. And that was really critical to us being able to kind of understand how to build the fidelity that we need for this device.
Well, low-cost ventilators now that are part of the stockpile of medical equipment that are so needed across this country, and you have delivered in a big way. Scott Cohen, co-founder of New Lab, this design firm that created a low-cost ventilator in the middle of a pandemic. Great to have you, Scott. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
We are discussing innovation, how innovation is meeting the moment now. And I'd like to bring in another guest, Associate Dean of Innovation at the MIT Sloan School of Management, Fiona Murray, co-director of MIT's Innovation Initiative. Fiona, great to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, Jane. Thank you for having me on today.
I'm curious, what did you hear in the story of an innovator like Steve Cohen?
I think in a story like that, what I hear is something that sounds a lot like the stories that we hear every single day at MIT. We have this extraordinary innovation community, and they're always experimenting. We train them to experiment, to be agile, to be fast, and to be focused. I was just online with 50 of our executive MBA students this morning presenting ventures that they've been developing while they're here. What I think is so striking at the moment is the way in which the entire community here at MIT, in universities, startups, large organizations around the country, and frankly around the world, have really rallied to COVID-19 and this need for crisis innovation with such passion and purpose. And I think it's that, it's the building bridges and the connecting and making sure that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts that has really been powerful.
Agile, fast, focused. I love that description. You're part of a remarkable program at MIT. It's a campus-wide initiative that brings students and faculty together for a singular cause of innovating in response to the coronavirus. Tell us what you're doing, Fiona Murray.
Of course. So we realized that during this time of COVID-19, during this time where we needed crisis innovation, we really needed to shift from sort of business as usual, where MIT's innovation engine is focused on creating and innovating, but on many, many different challenges, and that instead we needed to actually connect and convene and really converge around this single massive challenge and all the different elements that that involved. So we created this very simple rapid innovation dashboard that people could easily find at innovation.mit.edu. And we asked people to basically share with us all the different projects that were going on, from the sort of little eye, small innovation projects up to the really big eye innovation projects that were trying to do something transformative. We wanted to make sure that instead of having a lot of small scale projects, we could actually start to coalesce around some really significant projects. So just to give you one quick example, there were quite a lot of small hackathons already bubbling up in early March. We got the platform up in mid-March. On April the 3rd, we were able to have the COVID-19 Challenge, which was an online hackathon. We had almost 5,000 applicants for 1,500 places from over 100 countries. Again, with the protective equipment, our students and faculty absolutely wanted to dive into that problem. And we were really excited by the wealth of different ideas. But we know that if we want to get to impact, we've got to actually sort of start to coalesce around the best ideas. And so under the leadership of Marty Culpepper and one of our physician colleagues, Elazar Edelman, we were able to start to think about the particular materials, the design, and then make use of this enormous makerspace infrastructure that we have on campus that's normally used by the students every single day for their individual projects. We could rapidly transform that to focus on new designs for protective masks.
So what is this effort, the vision that you're seeing in these shared project and this feeling of sort of togetherness to create something great that will help in a time of crisis?
Yeah. What's so fascinating is that in this moment where we're all very socially disconnected in some ways because we're all sitting at home in our different living rooms and makeshift offices and what have you, that in fact we're all feeling very connected as a community around this shared purpose. And I think that is actually both important in a very practical sense, but it's also very important psychologically and emotionally because we can all really start to do something around that. Just to give you one other quick example.
Hold it till after the break, Fiona. We got to take a break here, but we'll get to it right after this. We're discussing how innovation is meeting this moment, how creative forces across the country are coming together for the common good. Much more after this break. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We are talking about innovation and how creative minds and divergent thinkers are bringing solutions to the problems of the coronavirus pandemic. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you. What innovations are you seeing in this moment of crisis? What's your company doing to innovate? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. With me from Boston, Fiona Murray. She's Associate Dean of Innovation at the MIT Sloan School of Management and co-director of MIT's Innovation Initiative. Fiona, before the break, you were telling us about the COVID-19 Rapid Innovation Dashboard and what you're doing at MIT, this extraordinary work of students, groups of students far and wide. You've got professors transforming their labs into COVID innovation spaces. You were describing an effort that's happening there now, and I wanted you to continue. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Yes, I just wanted to describe a couple of efforts that I hope give you a little bit of a flavor of some of the sheer enthusiasm and commitment. We have a big group of PhD students focused on analytics and operations research. 20 of them, under the leadership of my colleague, Professor Bert Seamus, have started to build tools around COVID analytics. They're working with hospitals here in Boston, and they're working really closely with Hartford Healthcare down in Connecticut so that those models don't just sit on the shelf or published in academic papers, but are actually being used on the front line every single day to make sure that we're optimizing the use of very precious resources like intensive care beds. I have another student who was just presenting this morning who has a new startup called Clara.ai, and she's rapidly building out a platform that's going to match the newly unemployed with all the emerging new COVID jobs, being able to really try to sort of make those job matches very, very quickly at a time when people really, really do need to find work in such difficult circumstances. And so she's drawing on students, she's drawing on her classmates, building connections with government officials. And we really do feel, I think, like a connected community. And the innovation ecosystem in Boston, down in New York, as we've just heard about, really those places with the strong social fabric and key connectors seem to be able to really move fast and build on the trusted connections that we've already had.
You describe it as sort of a wartime mentality, right? These are ideas that in normal times would be considered moonshots, right? And as I understand it, one of the biggest challenges you face is navigating and being agile around existing regulations, right? Tell us about that.
Yes, so certainly we've had a lot of war analogies, and I think we often compare this crisis innovation response from World War II to the one that we're doing today and that we're sort of on a war footing. I think one of the big differences that we see today is that whereas that was a lot about large corporations, today it's also about startup ventures who, as we talked about, are agile and focused and quite impact-driven. Whether that's sort of Moderna moving its vaccine activities into COVID, or companies like E25 Bio shifting from thinking about diagnostics in things like Zika straight to COVID. But you're absolutely right. One of the things that we have to do is we have to be fast, but we also have to be safe. And we have to, I think, understand the difference between rules and procedures that are basically there, that are sort of built up in a sort of cultural way over time, versus those that are actually really important for keeping us safe. Mm. And so we have always tried to make sure in everything that we do on campus that we are being as safe as possible. We have tremendous faculty expertise on campus and at the hospitals in how to work within appropriate medical regulations. But we also need to know when those regulations can be done much more quickly and more effectively, or we can reduce paperwork but not compromise safety.
I've got some listeners here who want to get in on this conversation. Pat is in Owing Mills, Maryland. Hi, Pat. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Hi. Go ahead. Well, thank you.
Thanks for taking my call. My first question is this all being driven by the possibility of you all making money? Have you been promised money? And if not, then why can't we design a civilization that is based on the commitment and courage of people addressing these issues regarding hunger and climate and all that sort of thing, rather than, we don't have the money to do this. We don't have the whatever.
Pat, great question. Fiona Murray, what is the motivation here? Is it the bottom line?
No, so we have not been promised any money for any of this. We're certainly seeing a lot of startup ventures who are shifting their activity from one set of product activities to another. And some of them are definitely finding investors who are really committed to having this sort of impact. And those are often long-term investors. Investors like MIT's Engine Fund are continuing to fund companies like BioBot, who are doing all the sewage analysis of COVID. Before that, they were working on the opioid crisis. So certainly we do need private capital. But I think what's driving us is really this desire for impact and this sort of passionate commitment. It's a very good question why we can't do this all the time. I think that there are pockets of our community and on many campuses and in these innovation ecosystems where we do see this. It just is focused on a whole range of different challenges and different moonshots, if you like. What we're seeing today is this intensity of focus. It's as if we've focused all the light and energy onto this one very particular thing. And so it's a really good question how we bottle some of this, some of the lessons from crisis innovation, so that we can use them when we start to move from crisis back to calm.
Is there one lesson that you've taken away so far that you would transfer to the world after this?
I think there's one positive lesson and perhaps one other lesson. So the positive lesson is when we set out a big, audacious, and important challenge that we can really feel, that really we can bring to life and has meaning to us, we can do this very rapidly. What makes that hard, of course, is that many of the big challenges that we have to tackle with the same commitment some of these moonshots are things that are going to affect us, you know, many years in the future, like climate change. And so trying to make those more real and concrete is very hard, but it's that concrete sense of reality that's important. The thing that I think is challenging that I perhaps wouldn't want to translate quite as much is the sheer intensity, the exhaustion that comes with that. Mm. And so I am concerned at how burned out. There's so much stress that goes along with the way we're all having to live at the moment as well, that I think we do need to be careful.
In fact, many of your ideas are already on the ground. You've already produced them. They're already in use. I read that you had a disposable plastic face shield that's now being worn by healthcare workers over their masks. You had a team of more than 100 people participating in the design, the production. And, you know, you made it fast. You made it cheap. You had prototypes ready in a matter of hours. And in about a week, these prototypes, these early prototypes were being shared with ER doctors and nurses. And you were making real-time modifications based on their feedback. I mean, this is real-time stuff, Fiona.
It really is. And in fact, this is actually what we teach. We teach about experimentation. We teach about learning. We teach about doing these very sort of agile loops. It's quite difficult, though, to bring that intensity to that. Normally, you have to sort of simulate that in the classroom, although we have our students do a really good job of making that feel real in hackathons. And they do go on to do this and behave in these ways. What we're seeing at the moment is this being sort of almost put on steroids in this moment of crisis. And I think we're seeing a real receptivity of the potential users. They absolutely want these solutions today. And so rather than it taking a few weeks to get a phone call and a meeting with somebody who might need your product, we're actually being able to sort of talk to them almost in real time and have them stand side by side with us at the lab bench, you know, in the with the 3D printer. And we're also being forced to think about scale. And I think that's something when we talk about innovation, we talk about taking ideas to impact. And the impact piece means we've got to be able to do things at scale. So elegant designs that are very difficult to produce at scale aren't really going to cut it. And that's, I think, an important lesson that we need to bring back into our classroom and into our conversations.
You've got 100,000 face shields a day now being made. That's pretty good. Listeners, you can join the conversation here. What sort of new thinking can help us through this moment? Innovators, what's your big idea right now? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. With me now from San Francisco, John Kao. He's a longtime strategic advisor to companies on innovation strategy and is chairman of the Institute for Large-Scale Innovation. John, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
So how do you see COVID-19 stimulating innovation right now?
Well, I think it matters what the time horizon is. So now we're in the middle of a crisis. And as Plato said, necessity is the mother of invention. We have a great sense of urgency. We have mortal stakes. People are dying. People are ill, which feeds into this notion that we're fighting this enemy and we need to be pragmatic and fast. If we look ahead to the medium and the long term, I think some of the impact is going to be about the dramatic unfreezing of the way we do our basic life activities. So how we collaborate from a work perspective, how we spend our leisure time, how we educate ourselves, how we participate in political processes. They're all up for review at this point because we've had to learn a whole bunch of new habits and inhabit a new set of tools. You know, there are times when I do the thought experiment and I say, well, what would the world be like if the pandemic had occurred 10 or 15 years ago? And a lot of what we've been talking about up until now in the show about speed and coordination and collaboration and networking really would have been much less feasible in an era where we were all walking around with clamshell cell phone, flip phones and bad cellular access. And then to do the other thought experiment about what would things have been like if the pandemic had struck, let's say, 15 years from now, where new kinds of systems for supporting education and collaboration and political processes might already be in place. So I think the bottom line here is that we see a massive unfreezing of our shared assumptions about how things are supposed to work. And that, of course, creates a tremendous opportunity for innovation and for the entrepreneurs who can drive the innovative new concepts to some level of fruition.
So how do these shared assumptions work when you're talking about government and academics and business working together to try to innovate? Does that work well?
Well, the shared assumptions that we've been talking about are about the value of preserving life and addressing the common good in terms of the public health. Going forward, I think one of the exciting aspects of all of this, and excitement has a positive and a negative connotation, is a word that Fiona used a couple of times, which is experimentation. We're in the middle of massive experiments that have to do with, you know, how does politics work in an era of social distancing, or will the bonds of affiliation between students and their undergraduate institutions fray when you're not physically sitting inside the ivied walls? And furthermore, when the issues of making a living become so much more important that moving into an era where credentialing and the availability of learning experiences out in the world, outside of the boundaries of specific learning institutions, create a very different set of options for young people who are entering into the workforce. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think there are a set of shared assumptions that remain to be created, which is why exactly why there are opportunities for entrepreneurship right now. There are vacant spaces.
Bill Gates famously warned about the likelihood of a pandemic back in 2015. He explained what he hopes will happen in the years to come to avoid the kind of situation we're facing today with innovation in the forefront of our minds. He spoke to TED Talk's Chris Anderson. Here he is.
There are innovations that are there that will get financed, I hope quite generously, coming out of this thing. And so 3 years from now, we'll look back and say, you know, that was awful. There's a lot of heroes, but we've learned the lesson. And the world as a whole, with its great science and desire to help each other, was able to try and minimize what happened there and you know, avoid it happening again.
Fiona Murray, is the innovation spirit that that you see at the MIT lab with your students around the world, are we ready to meet the challenge that Gates puts forth there?
I think we probably are. I mean, when we look around the world, and we have a tremendous number of international students, we work with regions globally. I've been hearing from really passionate innovators and entrepreneurs from the UK, where I'm from. One of my friends over there is originally from Lebanon, developed this extraordinary virtual reality surgery technology in her company Proxime that was really meant to help surgeons in war zones, but is actually now using that to help people retrain to be effective in ICUs. There are companies like Visita, which is in Egypt, who's moved directly from sort of making online appointments for patients to actually moving directly to telemedicine. Others in Nairobi thinking about how to actually turn private ambulance services. So first, I would say that this is quite global. I think that there's enormous potential and capacity for experimentation, for learning to be agile and to really show impact and commitment. But I think it's also important to say that much of our ability, even if we were unprepared for the pandemic itself, our innovation engine was well prepared to start experimentation and problem solving when this particular challenge arose. And that's because we've really had decades of investment in research and development. We've got strong global networks of scientific and technical collaboration. And we've been able to make, you know, multiple bets on different approaches to science. And we see that in vaccine development with all these different projects. Mm. And so I just want to sort of underscore that a lot of what's allowed us to be even remotely successful on the innovation front is because we've really had this strong commitment to research and development and this idea of sort of mind and hand, thinking and doing all along.
We were ready for it. Let's get Jordan in here from New Orleans, Louisiana. Our listener, Jordan, welcome to the program.
Hello. Hey, y'all.
Hi. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I'm calling from New Orleans. I have a small furniture company called Goodwood, and we partnered up with Ochsner Health System and Innovation Ochsner on March 18th to develop a face shield. And we have a very similar approach to what Fiona was talking about, where we prototyped, got, you know, prototypes on the floor very quickly, and were able to come up with a really good design. And our role within that was to really scale this thing up. So within 2 weeks, we had delivered 30,000, and by the end of the month, we'll have delivered almost 75,000 and fielding hundreds of other orders.
Wow. Wow. And is that just for Louisiana, or are you shipping them out of state, Jordan?
We're shipping them all over the country right now, mostly for dentists is what we've seen. A lot of dentists are in need of this PPE because they can't get it anywhere else.
Well, good work. Good for you, Jordan. Thank you so much for calling. Fiona Murray, there's an example, a furniture company turning to face masks. Yes. They're getting it done.
Yeah. What I love about this is it's reminding us that actually having manufacturing capability in the United States is incredibly important. And although we're also paying a lot of attention to these very innovation-driven startups and ventures, we also have, you know, part of the bedrock of our economy are these SMEs, these family businesses. And when we hear stories like this about, you know, furniture making, turning to working on other things, it's really heartening. Mm.
Good job, Jordan. Thanks for your call. We're looking at the role of innovation during crisis, during this coronavirus pandemic. Fiona Murray, John Kao, stick with me. We'll be back. Listeners, more to come. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about American innovation and ingenuity, unleashing our most creative thinkers to solve the most complex problems and fast. With us, Fiona Murray. She's Associate Dean of Innovation at the MIT Sloan School of Management and co-director of MIT's Innovation Initiative. And John Kao, he's chairman of the Institute for Large-Scale Innovation. Elon Musk has become one of the world's most celebrated innovators, having created leading companies for both electric cars and space exploration. In 2015, he explained why smaller companies are better at innovating.
If you look at innovation from large companies or from smaller companies are generally better at innovating than larger companies. And it has to be that way from a Darwinian standpoint, because smaller companies would just die if they didn't try innovating. Because otherwise people just keep buying the product from the big company.
Hmm. John Kao, what are the challenges for big companies when it comes to innovation? Why are smaller companies so much more effective?
Well, large companies, by definition, have to worry more about their current status. They're more laden with bureaucracy and legacy, and their core competencies can become core rigidities. Their expertise can become a set of blinders. And also, you know, small companies are more agile precisely because they are able to mix the key ingredients of innovation together much more rapidly. So that has to do with talent and ideas and resources. Whereas in companies, there are lots of mechanisms for controlling the combination of those resources. And therefore, you get slower progress, you get the need for bigger bets, you get careerism. I mean, the list of issues is very long. But at the same time, incumbent organizations have people, they have resources, they have intellectual capital, they have market position, they have market intelligence, they have lots and lots of assets. So it's, to me, not an either or, it's a both and. And in the era of networking and innovation ecosystems or ecosystem thinking, it is about how small and large can collaborate at times. I mean, certainly the other thing about small is that it favors new kinds of distributed models that rely on innovations in hardware and innovations in data science. You know, you look at this Kinsa thermometer company that's sending data about temperatures from now over a million of its products out in the field and predicting outbreaks of flu more rapidly than the CDC. Or Thayer Mahan, which is pioneering the use of robot sensors and artificial intelligence to do ocean monitoring at a time when we have to be very concerned about the 850 sailors on the USS Theodore Roosevelt who've fallen ill from COVID-19. So I think there are definitely advantages to being small because, in a sense, the future belongs to the many and the networked. And we are also in an era where we need lots and lots of experimentation. So we have well over 100 companies pursuing a new vaccine right now and over 100 companies that are pursuing new therapeutics for COVID-19 and many hundreds of companies that are optimizing face masks and sterilization techniques like Etron out in the West Coast. So I think that what we're seeing is an explosion of innovation across the spectrum from incremental to disruptive, and all are welcome because we are, as I said earlier, in this period of unfreezing. Mm.
Let me get another call in here from Madison, Wisconsin. Suzanne is on the line. Hi, Suzanne. Welcome to On Point. Hi.
Hi. I've got a contact tracing innovation that I've been using since February. This requires individual households to be encouraged to do this by, you know, powerful pulpits of mayors, governors, federal officials. Since February, I've been tracing my own household's contacts. Mm. It's a very simple form. It just shows name, date, contact, location, time period of contact, high, medium, or low contact, and who was contacted. Mm. In some cases, it's not possible to say who, but you can say, you know, this is the time period, and it was a male cashier at the grocery store. We don't have enough tracers right now. It's an integral requirement for the reopening of small businesses. Small businesses could also do this as a condition of reopening. I did do it just in written form, but the other day I created an Excel form so that data can be tracked. And if the tracers come for me, I'm going to have their data.
And you're ready to go. Suzanne, thank you. It's a great idea and a real need. John Kao, I mean, these ideas can come from anywhere. You talk about a kid who invented some ear guards for EMT workers. You know, this was requested by a local hospital to take the pressure off their healthcare workers. And here comes this kid with a 3D printer and patterns available for everyone.
A Canadian Boy Scout. Let's hear it for Boy Scouts. Yeah. And, you know, it was out of his empathy for healthcare workers who had irritation on their ears because of the elastic bands that go around the masks. And he developed a plastic extender that he 3D printed. Now it's a thing. You know, people demand vastly exceeds supply. So I think what we're seeing is the democratization of innovation in a sense. And I suspect that the outpouring of entrepreneurial energy in terms of actually taking these ideas and turning them into viable enterprises is going to accelerate. You know, in some respects, it's a very good time to be an entrepreneur, even though, you know, it's the best of times and the worst of times in the Dickensian sense. Mm.
Fiona Murray, you mentioned some startups that are shifting their focus pretty rapidly in this coronavirus moment. Shoot off a few of the companies that you see that are really making an impact. You mentioned BioBot, which is testing sewage for COVID-19. What are a couple of the others?
Yeah. So a couple of others, E25 Bio, who are developing their paper-based diagnostic, almost like a sort of pregnancy kit to be able to do a COVID diagnostic in about 25 minutes. Mm. 1UP Health, who are working with Mass Mutual, really trying to sort of make sure that we can all get our life insurance, even though we can't actually be close to one another. Primer, one of my other students, doing AI-based learning assistance. So quite a few really interesting things absolutely across the board. And I think this idea that we're going to see a continued outpouring reminds me a little bit of 2008. And after the economic crisis, we saw many more of our students deciding to go into startups and work, either create their own startups or work in growing companies because they felt as if they could have impact quickly. But we would remind them, as you mentioned before, that typically, if we really want to get things to scale, you very often have to work in partnership with global corporations and with governments. And so we need those skills. And we teach corporate innovation to help big companies leverage innovation ecosystems and work with startups, because it really is about the ecosystem and these different partners coming together, whether it's to deliver tracing, testing, vaccines at scale. We really do need these partnerships in place.
Well, Apple and Google, speaking of partnerships, are getting involved in the contract tracing business. What are the practicalities of that? Two big behemoths working together to, you know, produce solutions here. And to be honest, very real privacy issues associated with this as well, Fiona.
Absolutely. I mean, I think some of the security issues that are, in play at the moment, both in terms of sort of national security, but also in terms of security and privacy, are going to be very, very significant. And so while I think that it's really important to have some of the big players at the table, there are an awful lot of different innovative ideas coming from startups and other teams and research teams, including some collaborations here at MIT. So I think before we jump to a singular solution, we absolutely need to look at the portfolio of possible solutions. And without, you know, taking forever and writing, you know, 200-page reports, we really need to interrogate the security and privacy implications.
Let's get another listener in here from Richmond, Virginia. Joe is on the line. Hi, Joe. Welcome to On Point.
Hello. It's been an interesting conversation listening to all the innovative things that have come up, but I have yet to hear anybody talk about the preventive side of all this. You know, with the trillions of dollars as it's going to end up costing the world, the United States in particular, which is who I'm mostly concerned about. All this could have been prevented if they'd have followed proper medical protocols, which had been brought up to the forefront decades and decades ago when the business community and as well as the government, our government, wanted to get into this unrestricted globetrotting, you know.
Joe, let me take your point to Fiona Murray, because I think it's a good one. Preventative innovations, you know, sort of getting here to the first place. What do you say to Joe's comment, Fiona?
Well, I think with anything medical, we know that prevention is always much, much cheaper and much, much more effective than the cure. If I want to just put this in a slightly broader perspective, I think as human beings, we have a very, very difficult time imagining very low probability, very sort of significant events. And so even though that we had warnings and we understood that there was a very real possibility of a pandemic of this kind, it's been quite difficult to for governments and others to really sort of cut through the challenge of wanting to spend money on things that are much closer and feel more proximate until they actually arrive right in front of us. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I hope comes out of this is a real willingness for us to wrestle with and reckon with the fact that we need to make investments in, you know, possible future outcomes and future scenarios that may not come to pass, but if we completely ignore them, we won't be ready.
Joe, thanks so much for your call. Here's another innovator, Jeff Bezos, the founder and CEO of Amazon. He urges companies to embrace risk in order to maximize innovation. He spoke at the Air Force Association's Airspace and Cyber Conference in 2018. Here he is.
To be innovative, you have to experiment. If you want to have more invention, you need to do more experiments per week, per month, per year, per decade. It's that simple. You cannot invent without experimenting.
Experimenting, yes, Fiona, but how does that match up with a crisis moment where you got to do it fast, where you're looking for, where speed matters, right?
Well, I think it was Thomas Edison who talked about how many experiments he could fit into a 24-hour period. And so experimentation is both about what we learn. It's about learning, but it's about very rapid learning loops. And in fact, I think a lot of the new technologies that are allowing us to be a little more successful now, whether it be gene sequencing and what have you, is because some of the experimental infrastructure is much, much more rapid than it used to be. But this point about taking risk and experimenting is exactly, I think, the point, which is when we think about these possible futures, we're going to have to do research and development innovation that's quite risky. And that means that we've got to be able to embrace the possibility that not everything will work. And while we might have to think of it as failure, it's also a learning opportunity. And that means that governments, large organizations, social services have to be willing to try new things and recognize that it's not 99 out of 100 times it's going to work. It's probably maybe half the time. And that is still a good use of public money if we're really focused on big, risky, important challenges.
Let's get to Gary in Richmond, Rhode Island. Hi, Gary. Not much time. A quick question, please. Go ahead.
Hi, yes, of course. Just wanted to add, to me, it looks almost like we're fighting the old war, like we used to say in the military, you know, the dangers of fighting the next war is the paradigm of fighting the old war. A lot of these solutions, innovations-wise, I mean, I have an engineering and science background, Navy pilot. I feel that a lot of this is fighting the old war in the kinetic barriers that innovators are trying to create, not in a humorous sense, almost like Trump's wall, so to speak, face shields. They fit into sort of the same paradigm. I wonder if maybe the innovators on the panel could talk about human, just basically not human experimentation, but just some of the tried and true basics of human immunity and human health and things like that.
Gary, thanks. I've only got about a minute here. John Kao, do you want to tackle that?
Well, there's no question that there's a huge frontier in terms of basic and applied biological research that will affect our immunity. There's been discussion of a pan-virus kind of hypothetical cure that would cover a wide range of potential pathogens. That really does speak to the notion of being able to marshal innovation at scale. And I think this whole experience of the pandemic is going to force us to sit back a bit and kind of reimagine what an American innovation capability would look like, which is a question that my team and I have been grappling with for a number of years, because we need to water the roots of our innovation capacity. I don't disagree with Fiona around the fact that we have abundant resources, but if we don't continue to invest in basic science and the pillars of education and talent development and so forth and so on, we won't get the moonshot results in the medium to long term that could address this notion of changing the nature of the game as opposed to creating the more kind of palliative barriers that our call-in guest has just referred to.
So build on that, Fiona Murray, for our last question here. With your work at MIT and these students that are flourishing around the world with these incredible innovative ideas, it seems to me this crisis could create a sort of generation of purpose-driven innovators motivated by principle, right, and purpose, not just the bottom line here, Fiona.
Absolutely. I think that we have among us an enormous global community of innovators who have passion and purpose. And I think if we can really tap into that innovative spirit, both here in the US and around the world, we really are going to build an innovation engine that I hope will take us through the crises that will surely inevitably come our way. The thing that I would say, though, is that we just need to make sure we do that in as inclusive a way as possible. These innovation ecosystems that we have here in Boston and Silicon Valley, London, you know, are extraordinary places. But I think it's really important that we do this in a way that's inclusive of everybody.
A good way to end, and a really interesting conversation. Fiona Murray, Associate Dean of Innovation at the MIT Sloan School of Management and co-director of MIT's Innovation Initiative. Fiona, thank you very much for your time, for your insights today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And John Kao, chairman of the Institute for Large-Scale Innovation. John, thanks very much to you as well.
Much appreciated.
You can continue the conversation, listeners. Get our On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. Stay safe and healthy. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.